Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to the Pardes Institute. That means shalom, and welcome to Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shalom.
Oh, shalom, Yishai.
Welcome How you home. Doing? All right, great. Yeah, I was away from home. I was at another ancient city, not as ancient as this one, certainly, but an old city.
Far from young.
Far from young, and a very cool city, Krakow. One of those kind of magical places in Europe. You know what I'm talking about? Like Sarajevo, Prague.
I've never actually been anywhere other than, where was I? Just recently? Latvia.
Latvia. Okay. Okay. I don't know much about Latvia.
Neither do I, but I was there.
Okay. But Krakow is not only is it a pretty ancient city, actually, but also one that has a lot of Jewish history. And in fact, today, that's a money-making enterprise since the Jewish quarter has been kind of revived with all these kosher-style restaurants and kosher-themed restaurants are not actually kosher. And synagogues. I actually got to say Kaddish in Krakow, not very far from where the Ramah is buried, Rabbi Moshe Israelis. I went to the Isaac Synagogue, and there was a Chabad. Chabad has taken over the Isaac Synagogue, which was built, I think, in the 1500s. Beautiful synagogue. And I was there with one of the great teachers of our time, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. And when I say teacher, I want to tell you that here's an unusual image. Imagine being with Shmuley Boteach, his wife, five or six kids, one of their friends, one of their daughters is driving the car, me, Yishai Fleischer, and my good friend Eric, the Dominican monk. My friend Eric Ross, the Dominican monk, okay? And we're all in a Volkswagen car together, and we're typing into, I wish it was Waze, but she used Google, the Google Maps, because it would have been a little bit more perfect if it was Waze, the Israeli.
You could have fudged it.
And she's typing in, you know, into the maps, like Auschwitz-Birkenau.
How does a Jew get to Auschwitz? Oh, that's terrible.
It's like this van full of Jews trying to get to Auschwitz-Birkenau. And then, and we were there. And what can I tell you? You know, really, words are not, they're hard to exactly describe. It was one of those days that Primo Levi talks about, these beautiful days at Auschwitz,
yes,
which are like once, like throughout the year, there's like a week or two or three that is like that. But the rest is like dark weather, bad weather. Like 3 out of 4 days in Poland, in that area, is overcast. And foggy and cloudy, or whatever it is, and rainy, precipitous. But we were there in one of those beautiful days, and Auschwitz was bad. Birkenau, much worse. Mm-hmm. Much worse. And Shmuley Boteach, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, super knowledgeable. I'm talking about to the minutia level of which were the crematoria and where's the gas chambers and all that. I think number one place that really moved me was actually going into the sole surviving gas chamber there at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And then seeing the gas chamber, and then next door is the crematoria where they like dump the bodies. And just to see that, it was just like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to say exactly, because it was just like, there's really no words exactly to say. Like, we all know the words. We all know how horrific, you know, monstrous death machine, all that kind of death factory.
Words dull the reality.
Right.
To have to actually look at it has a visceral impact that actually description almost prevents.
The one description I could say is that my wife, God bless her, said to me, every square inch there has Jewish blood on it.
Yes.
In Auschwitz-Birkenau. And also when I told her I'm going to Auschwitz-Birkenau, which was not a plan, because I was there for a different kind of anti-Semitism or a related kind of anti-Semitism. I'll explain that in a second. She just started crying. She was like, my family, that's where we went. She's Hungarian Jewish.
Mine as well.
Right.
Romania.
There you go. So I was there, but I was really there for a different kind of anti-Semitism, which is the meeting of UNESCO, the United Nations Cultural, Scientific, Educational Organization, not in that order. And they're out there deciding that Jerusalem is not sovereignly under Israel. And they're trying to say that Marat HaMachpelah, the Tomb of the Fathers and Mothers in Hebron, where I work, is actually a Palestinian World Heritage Site.
You know what makes me think of this comparison? It makes me think of the Seder, of Seder night, where we read that Lavan bikesh lakor takol, right? There's a comparison between Pharaoh, who just wanted to kill our children, and Lavan, who wanted to like uproot everything. And you know, it's like always a question,
Levon.
Come on, okay, he was a trickster. Shot really, he wasn't so bad. Like, what, comparing him to Faro? You know, he would be case la corte col. He wanted to uproot everything. Why? Because when he chased after Yaakov and he finally caught up to him, what did he say? He said, these children are my children. These women are my women. You're no different than me. This is my story. And in doing that, he was going to erase the entire breed, the entire covenant between Yaakov and God that was playing out. And that's what I see what's happening in UNESCO.
That's a fabulous analysis. I have to tell you.
They're not trying to kill us directly and throw us into gas chambers, although, as we know, there are plenty of people there who wouldn't mind. But what they're doing is trying to erase our past and thus make us insignificant.
Well, the only caveat I would add to that is I think that's a great understanding between those two anti-Semitisms that were happening that I saw in Krakow at one time. The only difference is not difference. The only thing I would add to what you said is UNESCO's will to la korot hakol, to undermine everything, the whole Jewish story, is also a justification for the final solution.
Yes, for sure.
Murder. Meaning to say, they want to undermine every justification of us being here so that they can justify the jihad against us and, yes, exterminate us.
There is a war front. It is not purely an intellectual, historical endeavor.
Right. It's if anything, it's a kind of 1-2 punch. And if you remember the Nazi regime, it was first the artillery of the mind of Goebbels who set the stage for delegitimizing the Jewish person as a...
Dehumanizing
him. And then afterwards, setting into motion, you know, the rest of
the final solution. Right.
So, to me, they are doing that.
I hear it. Okay.
Anyway, excellent distinction. I was there. I was with Shmuley Boteach. It was an amazing thing. And then I finally did what I actually wanted to do, which is to grab a beer with Eric over there in Krakow. Which is, by the way, a very lovely town, a very interesting town.
I just always think about the fact that he told me he's still living in the Middle Ages there in Poland.
You know, there was a big Jewish festival the week before. I came there exactly the day after, and the theme was Jerusalem.
And really?
That was the theme. And in his monastery, in Eric's monastery, they were part of the Jewish festival. You really, I'd love to see you get there to speak there at the Jewish festival. 1 year, and they displayed old pictures of Jerusalem. One of the thing about the Dominicans is that they're very intellectual.
They're the scholars of the Catholic Church,
exactly.
For sure.
And
always have been. They were founded for that purpose.
Right. And they keep these. They were also very interested in photography. They have a lot of early photographs of Jerusalem.
Really.
And they displayed that, and it was also again very very moving. Anyway. Sometimes in life, you get into these moments where you're like in a Jewish microwave, where you're like in a microwave moment of Judaism.
What does that mean?
It's like one time I was in my wife's grandparents' house, and they had this little TV room, mm-hmm. and they were sitting there across from me on the couches. Sometimes Hungarians do that; they may put a couch and across from another couch so you can sit and talk. That's the way we did it in mine and Malka's house also, and they're sitting across from me, and the TV had thing about Masada. And all around in that little room, they had paintings of Jewish themes, like good things and bad things. And at the same time, when they had their shirt sleeves rolled up.
And their survivors.
And their survivors, you see the numbers on their hand. And my kids were there. And then the grandfather, Grandpa Mike, he kept on going to me, do you know your posuk? Do you know your posuk, right? and like every person has a name, has a posuk to it. And then he starts going, you know why you have to have your posuk? You have to have your posuk because the Malach HaMovis, when he comes and gets you, asks you your posuk. And at the same time on TV, it's like, and the Jews died on Masada. And then the things around. And my children are like, Mommy, Daddy. And then they had the handout with the numbers. Do you know your posuk? The Jews died on Masada.
So it's a Jewish pressure cooker, not just a microwave.
That's what it was like in Krakow. I was like, here's the Ramah Synagogue. Here's the Jewish people of death. Here's a Jewish theme, festival on Jerusalem. Here I go to Auschwitz with Shmuley Boteach. You know, it's like a crazy thing. I go into a monastery. Inside, there's pictures of Jerusalem. You know, it was just like one of these things where you're like, oh, my God. Anyway, as we talk about these themes, we would be remiss if we did not enter the world of this week's Torah portion. I remember we talked about this last year. How suddenly the narrative shifts in this Torah portion called Balak. Oh, by the way, this is the Land of Israel Network. Jeremy Kimpel told me that you forgot to mention, that I forgot to mention in the last show.
Oh.
So I was happy that Jeremy, one of the co-founders of the Land of Israel Network, reminded me. So the Land of Israel Network is where you're at with many other great shows, including your show, The Jewish Story, which I hear is just doing fabulous from people.
Bezrat Hashem.
Yeah, people tell me all over the world now that they listen to your show. I'm very happy about that. Very proud to have had a small hand in that. I'm very happy.
More than small.
Yeah. And so Jeremy Kimpel, Ari Abramowitz reminded me, the Land of Israel Network. And my email is Yishai at the Land of Israel Network.
Rabbi Mike.
Rabbi Mike.
Rav Mike.
Rav Mike. That's good. Very good.
Rav I know Mike. My own email. I really
That's
do.
That's right. Rav Mike at thelandofisraelnetwork.com. And this Torah portion is could be arguably one of the more entertaining, more fascinating,
for
more
sure.
easy reads, more exciting than ever before.
I don't know about easy read. There's some confusing stuff at the end.
There's confusing stuff, but the point is like I meant to say by easy read, you want to read through it. It's a page turner. That's what
it
I
is
mean.
A page-turner.
Page turner, and it's about Balak, right? Balak is a Moabite king, and he's going to invite this sorcerer, this kind of bizarro prophet, to come and cuss the Jews out. In the name of God, and you there's a lot of mixing here. There's a lot of mixing of metaphors and things. Prophets, I thought that was a Jewish thing. I thought Jews are prophets, and cursing the Jews, you're supposed to be blessing the Jews, you know. And there's just going to be a lot of confusing stuff. So let's just jump right into it. Anything to add right in the beginning? Maybe I want to ask you the question: shouldn't this Torah portion be called Bilam? This Torah portion is about Bilam. Bilam is the evil prophet. Bilam is the dark protagonist, or let's call him hero. I don't know, the antagonist that is featured in this chapter of the Torah, but yet the Torah portion is called Balak, which is this king of Moab who what realizes that he's not going to be able to withstand the Jews, the Israelites coming to the land of Israel, and he needs to use a different weapon here, mm-hmm. not the regular weapon of war.
Of swords, but rather of the voice. Yeah, I hear it. It's a great question. What came up for me when you asked it is this is also a morally complex parsha because as long as the lens stays in the first person narrative from the perspective of Am Yisrael, so things are very clear. God's talking to us. He's telling us to go to this land. We've been slaves. We're wandering around, and our enemies are the faceless mass of immoral Canaanite peoples who really deserve it anyway, and let's just get them out of the way and get on with business. By the very virtue of switching to the perspective of the enemy,
the other,
right? The Torah throws a huge wrench in what would be an otherwise very clean story. You know, I saw recently one of the most popular history books of the last 2 years was a story of D-Day, of the Normandy invasion from the perspective of a German soldier. Could you imagine more than, say, let's say 15 years ago or earlier, someone writing a story of D-Day from the perspective of a German soldier?
I never thought of that.
Yeah, but they were plenty of them there, obviously. And so in the same way, that's what's happening here. And I think really that's the critical reason this is called Balak, because the Torah wants to post us the fact that, yes, there are, even though we're not questioning the mission, we're not undermining the morality, nevertheless, for a full look at what's happening, you have to actually see, as his descriptions are, they're going to eat us up. They're going to, like, you know, lick up like an ox licks the grass off the land, et cetera. Why isn't it called Bilam? Because Bilam, in the end of the day, he's just a freelance evil person.
Right.
I mean, he cursed somebody to get Balak into his position. Now you want me to curse these folks? God knows if the Jews had come to him and said, curse Balak, if they'd been willing to shell out, he'd have done that too. So his perspective is actually not...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not what brings moral nuance.
He's not
nuance.
A stakeholder here.
No, but he represents the perversion of vision,
right,
as we're going to get to, right? Even though he's forced to see things that perhaps he didn't want to. Whereas Balak, despite the fact that he and his people are going to go, his perspective is a real one and therefore important.
Maybe I'll throw in also that he's a Moabite. His perspective is important, but also there is here hidden a few times in the text messianic ideals.
For sure.
And we do know that Ruth is a descendant of this Balak, of Balak. She is a Moabite princess. And later on, she's going to be the progenitor of King David.
That's right. So meaning that his perspective has to be integrated into the story from the outset.
Right. We have to know him a little bit. We got to see.
Got to see it. It's a messy story.
Right. Okay, here we go. So basically, Jews are coming. They're parked right across the street from Midian. From Moab, and they're getting nervous out there, both the Midianites and the Moabites, and they decide to send a message to again this bizarro prophet, the sorcerer Bilam ben Beor, and they are saying, come over and curse Israel for me. They send officials and money, presumably like honorifics to Bilam. Bilam says, I have to ask God because I can't do anything. God doesn't let me. God says, who are the folks with you? Who are these folks? And here you got, if you believe in God, right at the beginning, you're saying there's a test being thrown at Bilam. Like, does he really think God doesn't know? Or is he going to fall for this idea that he has to tell God exactly what's going on? Right from the get-go, there's this thing. He says, who are these people? Bilam says, well, they're here to ask me to curse the Jews. God says, no, don't do that. I don't want you to do that. They're a blessed people. And then they come again with greater gifts, greater officials. They ask again, and this time he kind of asks God again. God says, okay, go ahead. You can go with them. And he ends up going with them, right? So what's that all about?
So I think the two are related, because that question then God says, who are these people? Is one that brings us all the way back to the book of Genesis, back to Bereshit, because that type of invitation happened twice at the birth of humanity. Once with Adam Arishon, with the first man, when God says to him, Ayeka, like, where are you right now, Adam? And obviously God knows what it is. It's an invitation that Adam asks himself, where is he? What has he done? But unfortunately, Adam is hiding. And when God says to Cain, after he's killed Abel, where is your brother Abel?
Right.
Right? Uh-huh. It's, again, once again, an opportunity to own who he is and what he's done. And yet he says, what? Hashomer achi anochi? Am I my brother's keeper? The answer, which, of course, is yes. People often forget that. And so here we see the same thing. Wait, who are these people? Bilam says, haha.
God doesn't know.
And so what we
I
see
pull
is
a fast one over again.
Yeah, and so what we see as a consequence is the exact same in the other two cases.
Instead of saying, for example, like the prophet Jeremiah, who says, like, Jeremiah, what do you see? And he's like, you know,
I see not olive branch, a almond branch.
Right, but a lot of times he says, God, you know. Oh, right. no, excuse me, I mean in the bones of Ezekiel.
Yes.
He says, will these bones rise up? He says, God, you know.
Right.
You're the one who knows. And the question then becomes rhetorical. He recognizes that God is kind of testing him, and he throws it back and he says, "You're the knower, not me." Here, you don't see that. You don't see him being like, God, you know, you're the knower. Who am I?
And if Bilam had owned the sense that yes, and I want to go because they make me feel important, they're going to give me lots of money and power, etc. If he'd owned that from the outset, it might have been a very different story. But instead, right. God took him, because this is what happens in life when you get a question and you don't look behind the question and see what's really being asked. You get led in the way that you wanted to go. And so God says, okay, yeah. You go right down that road. See where that ends.
You touched a sore nerve there.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
You zanged me in the tooth right there, you know?
Like, why is that?
Because I just like, when you ask God, like, what should I do? And I've been asking God, I've been having a challenge about where my next living place is. And it's just like, am I listening to myself, what I want or what God wants? And it just you zap me with that. You zap me with that feeling, because it's so darned easy to listen to yourself and then call it in the name of God.
Absolutely.
That I've explained this 10 times on the show, but I say it again. That is the root of idolatry. The root of idolatry is when you make something else a god that gives you license.
Yes.
Your god gives you license to do what you want.
Yes.
And so and as a Jew, you got to really be. Oh, it's zinging me. It's zinging me. Okay, it's close to home. Any case, now the famous story of the donkey. It's more correct to say it's not a donkey exactly. It's a natton. What's that thing called?
An ass.
It's a mule, isn't it?
No, really? It's not a mule. A mule is a parrot.
A parrot. Okay, so here's
it's a donkey. It's a female donkey.
Female donkey. So this female donkey. Has been the companion, and our rabbis tell us that's been a companion
in many ways,
of Bilam's, and this gentle godly animal, has been carrying Bilam from since he was a young man. And this time, God, though he allows him to go, in fact, God is not happy, and he sets an angel of war. The angel of war, and this is an image that I think appears at least three famous times. Once here, the angel with the sword. Second time with Joshua as he enters the land of Israel. And third time with King David right above the Temple Mount area, the Goren Hatad, Goren Arnava Yivusi, right? The threshing floor of the Jebusites.
I got to see the bedrock of Mount Moriah with our good friend Zev Orenstein yesterday. It was an incredible experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the bedrock, right where the cornerstone of the Temple Mount rests. It's an incredible
thing. It's chazak.
It is.
It's so chazak. It's so real. It's so right there. And so anyway, this angel with the sword, our friend Zev from Ir David, from the City of David, this angel with the sword is now standing in front of Bilam, and it's going to end up standing in front of him three times. Every time the donkey sees this sword, the angel with the drawn sword, and we'll try to
avoid
it. First time going the wrong way, second time smushing
against
Bilam's log against the wall, and the third time just crouching down in fear. And in the meantime, Bilam striking mercilessly at this animal, hitting it with a stick hard. You get a feeling that he's really hitting this animal, and this is the most amazing thing. God then opens the mouth of the donkey. This is not the Grimm's fairy tales here, you know what I mean? This is the Bible here, and the Bible says that God opened the donkey's mouth, and the donkey's like, "Hey man, why are you hitting me?" and Bilam is like, "You know, if I had a sword, I would just run you through right now." And he's like, "Really? That's how the donkey sounds. Really? Really? Is that the way it really is?"
I think donkey talks like Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, like Eddie Murphy. It's like that what you really want to do? and it says, "Listen, I've been your faithful donkey your faithful steed for you know, all these years. You know, have I deserved this?" And Bilam here says, "No." He says, "Lo," right? That's the one word answer. And then God reveals this angel of war before
opens
him. Opens his eyes, and he's like, "Dang, I was wrong."
This to me is just the follow through of,
by the way,
where we begin.
Just one thing. It keeps saying that. The word regalim, three pilgrimages, three times.
Right, periods, like, you
right,
know, these cycles.
This was three times that the donkey, you know, did this maneuver, and the three times that he hit. And he says, "Why'd you hit me these three times, these regalim?" But it's an allusion, like a writ large allusion to the pilgrimage to Jerusalem.
Well, it's the merit of those he's trying to destroy, which is actually what's preventing him. But I want to stay focused on Bilam right now, because this is a very important, if we're going to play out the psychology of it, like we said, God gave him an opportunity to know himself. Who are these people? He decided, "No way, I'm going for the big money." And so God said, "Okay, I'll take you there." But at the same time, what happens? It's like, not God doesn't abandon anyone. He doesn't abandon anyone. You know, until you really have made the choice to jump off the cliff, God will always try to take you in the right way. So he sends this angel to stop him. And what happens? Not only is Bilam blind to the fact that the obstacles in front of him are saying, "Hey man, you're going the wrong way," he actually beats his donkey. I mean, he is so eager to ignore and push out of his way the obstacles that stand between him and his evil desire that he causes injury to one of his most intimate relationships. I mean, there's an important metaphor here in how people behave. And that, by the way, I think is the real sign. I think when we make decisions, it's very difficult to know whether we're hearing ourselves speaking in the voice of God,
right,
or God. But really the test case is, as I begin to go down that path, do I have to force this through my intimate relationships, or do I find that the people around me that I trust and that I know are saying, "Yeah, this is the matim lecha, like this is the way to go," you know, and are supportive in it. Do I have to push this through, right, at some level, or does it find a consonance with the rest of my life? It's not always true, but I think it's often. I think that our relationships that we trust can become a good barometer for knowing whether we're really listening to God or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm hitting that nerve.
I think that a person that lives with God can say, "Wow, my donkey went the wrong way three times. Like, what, could this be a sign for me? Could this be, is Providence telling me something a little
bit?"
You know, is it, you know what I mean? And let me ponder. Let me meditate. But instead we see the classic fault of losing his temper, you know, the anger, succumbing to darkness. And basically, you know, this is very important to know. Everybody should know this super fundamental thing in Judaism that people may not know, which is there are basically, the Rambam lines up two traits, only two traits, which he says a person should be at the extreme. And that is to rid yourself of haughtiness and rid yourself of anger.
Yes, and that's the two go hand in hand.
Right, exactly. Basically, if you read between the lines, if you don't read between the lines, it looks like Bilam is this, you know, reasonable person, kind of. But if you read between the lines, you're like, this guy is totally full of himself. He's totally full of himself, and he's succumbing to anger. Any case, he hits the donkey, sees the light, sees the angel, offers to go back home and to kind of turn around on this mission. I mean, nice offer. You were about to get slayed by a fiery angel with a sword. But in any case, the fiery I added. But anyway, God says, no. You can go. Go ahead.
We're carrying this one through.
Right. But remember, by the way, if I was an artist, I'm thinking of myself as like some kind of Baroque artist or something like that. I'm just like, this, I would paint this.
Somebody has to have painted this.
I would paint this crouching, you know, donkey and the sword drawn by the angel and Bilam, this weird prophet.
Ignorant magician.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes like think of these Bible scenes of just like, that's art right there, you know. Or I really like from a few Torah portions ago, Aaron standing with his
between life and death
with the smoke thing. Just like, that's awesome. Or I would love to see Samson carrying the gate up to the mountains of Hebron. Anyway, whatever. Just me imagining I'm in a giant castle with my own artists. Anyway, weird. Anyway, let's keep going.
Wall hanging.
Speaking of castles, let's take a tiny break for just a little second. I want to tell you, there's a new sponsor for the show. I'm very excited about this because I am, like yourself, I'm a Lego fan.
Yes.
Are you a Lego fan?
I am. Spent many good hours with my son, plus right. in my own childhood.
When you let me ask you a question. You see your kids playing Lego. Uh-huh. Your thought is?
Oh, that's great.
Great, right?
That's great.
You see them not on their phone, playing with Lego, building something, and then they come to you and they show you something pretty
so
cool.
Proud of it. They're so proud.
And
yeah.
What do you think?
I think this is awesome.
This is good, right? Yeah. Lego is gematria good, okay? It's just good, right? Lego. And it's interesting, when we were kids, our parents used to spend big money. When I was in Israel, a little kid, 30 years ago, whatever, like, they would spend a lot of money to buy you a Lego set. Today, it's much more doable. Interesting, most toys kind of go away, right?
Right.
This toy is hotter today than it was, by far, than it was when we were kids.
It's amazing.
The Lego Movie, Lego Land, but plain old Lego that you buy is still just a Lego.
It's just a great toy.
But most of the pieces are the same pieces that you and I use.
Well, there's only so many ways you can make a square or a rectangle.
Anyway, I was just, a guy wrote to me, his name is Yitzi. Yitzi was on my Birthright tour many years ago, and he started a company called J-Brick. J-Brick. You know, like J-Date? This is J-Brick. And and J-Brick is all about Jewish Lego pieces. Jewish Lego pieces. And they're amazing. I saw some of them. They're really like, he's got a Beit HaMikdash set. Oh. He made a giant menorah.
Does he have a shtetl?
Does he have a Baal Shem Tov house?
Yeah.
From Medjugorje?
He's got to have 770 in the market alone.
You can't have a Lego, Jewish Lego brand without a 770. Come on, that's right. Okay, anyway, Yitz has always dreamed of creating Jewish custom Lego sets. His first product was a 3-in-1 menorah set, sold out in just 1 week after launch. And he uses only genuine Lego parts. And it's just, he's got a 3-in-1 menorah for Hanukkah, 2-in-1 Seder plate for Passover. It's really, honestly, he's got a mezuzah. A real mezuzah cover made out of Lego. I tell you, but man, no joke, I saw this and I was in love. And I begged him to let me advertise his stuff on my show because I like it so much. He's got a great Facebook page. And a great website. It's jbrick.com. jbrick.com. Now listen, you order, tell them that Yishai sent you. It'll be good for the world. Maybe we'll get some reduced price. We'll see. We haven't worked out even all the details. I'm just starting to really let you know about this, and it's like one of my, it's just a great thing. I want your kids to play with this. On this show, you will only get advertisement of things that I truly believe in, and I think that will work for your family. So the website is jbrick.com, jbrick.com. If you forget it, write me an email saying, Yishai, what's that Lego thing? Write Jewish Lego. And I think it's a fabulous product. I want your kids to play with it. And I'm waiting for my first, he has a 135, 1 to the 35th scale size of the Kotel, Noah's Ark. He's making, I want him to make a giant set. We'll talk about that
Mount
later.
Mount Sinai.
Right. It's really fun. You can make a whole thing.
Good stuff
you can make a whole thing. Armageddon. No.
Oh,
sorry, I didn't say that. He's got Israeli, look, he's got Chayalot. He's got Wonder Woman, the new one.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, Yitzi from J Brick is doing a great job together with his wife, and I want you guys to check it out. Chani, his wife Chani, who has a degree in finance, is the business manager. Anyway, check out jbrick.com as part of the Yishai Fleischer show here on the Land of Israel Network together with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, where were we at?
We had just arrived. You know, Bilam has finally met up with Balak.
Okay.
And we're about to get down some serious curses.
All right. It's like, hey, man, why didn't you come to me earlier? You know, don't you want me to honor you? He's like, listen, only God can honor me. You can't give me, unless you give me kind of a house full of gold.
Hint, hint, wink,
yeah,
wink.
Yeah, that's what I really want. I can't do anything. Okay, all right, let's start getting to work. Let's go up on one of these mountaintops. I will show you the edge of the Jewish people. I'm going to get back to this point in a minute. I'll show you the edge of the Jewish people. No problem. It's time for some rites. Rites. I don't mean like civil rights. I mean like R-I-T-E-S. Like
right. Ritual rites.
Ritual rites. Okay. How many is it? 12?
Seven.
Seven. Seven. Seven bulls.
Well, seven altars.
Seven altars.
You know, something on each one. I think it was a bull and a calf and a ram.
Just for a second, folks, remember what that means. What does it mean to offer up seven bulls? Just think what that means. Making seven altars and seven bulls. Just, this is no small thing, really.
There's a lot of blood.
Yeah, there's a lot of blood, a lot of stuff, a lot of meat smell out there. You know, it's very, very raw. If I would be sacrificing seven things, you know that I'd be in a state. You know, you're killing animals, whole thing. Okay, and he says, listen, I want you to curse the Jewish people for me. And they're going to business. He takes a walk. Bilam takes a walk. And then he, let me read this to you. Hashem put an utter, God happened upon Bilam, which is, by the way, a kind of negative phraseology, which is not the holiness of God appeared or God spoke with, but God happened upon Bilam and said to him, I have prepared, Bilam says to him, I have prepared the seven altars and brought up a bull and a ram on each altar. Hashem put an utterance in Bilam's mouth and said to him, go back to Balak and thus shall you say. So what's going to happen now? I would think a lot of, like he was hired to curse, right?
Well, but the image is very powerful of the placing of his word in his mouth. You know, it takes me, we mentioned Ezekiel before, like to me one of the most powerful images of prophecy is that it's a point in early on in the book of Ezekiel, I forget which chapter, where God actually has him eat a scroll. He has a vision and he says, open your mouth, and God is just, you know, he like basically shoved that whole scroll down that goes inside you.
It was made from a sugar.
Right, it was a
sugar pastry.
Yeah, there you go. There's a word for that.
Whatever. There's a word. Don't worry about it.
Now, let it go.
But he did eat a scroll. That's right.
But what it is it's the side of prophecy which has nothing to do with the prophet. Mm-hmm. That he is a vehicle. And
right.
This is the lesson that Bilam really has to learn here in terms of that quality of arrogance which he brings, that he believes that he has this power. Like the sages say that his great power was that he could tell the moment when God's wrath was sort of ascendant within the divine, you know, being, so to speak.
Right.
And so he thinks that there's a mechanistic sort of power which can be controlled here. And God basically pulls his mouth open,
right,
drops something in there and says, now go home. Give him a little patch across the face and said, don't forget, there's only one thing to say here.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with you.
Right. You basically, he's taken away his free will. In
yes.
A sense. It's a very important point that you made. I just want to dwell on it for a second. Bilam's system is that he thinks he can manipulate God.
Yes.
He knows when God's angry moment is.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Check this out. This actually also explains to us, or is explained by what the donkey says to him. Don't you have a view on history? Don't you see the big picture? I've always been with you.
Mm.
I've been good to you. there's a moment right now. Are you going to exploit this moment of anger and strike me down now or see the big picture? No. Bilam is angry at that moment. That's exactly what he wants to exploit in God, that moment of anger. And this is exactly also why for the first two times, the first two curses that end up being blessings, there's an effort to only see the edge of the Jewish people. See a small part of it.
Sure.
Okay, and that to me as a media guy is exactly what our enemies are doing today. They are trying to show a smidgen of the Jewish people, a soldier pushing an Arab or something like that, and say, that's the truth. Hey, world, here's what Israel is. Now curse them.
Right.
Now curse them.
Right.
Right? Because this is what Israel is. It's like, don't see the big picture. Don't see the life and the goodness and the fact that... And I was arguing with I wouldn't even call him a liberal Jew because he has lost his liberalness. He was just foaming. I would call him a foaming Jew. And I'm just like, bro, your values that you're trying to espouse, that's Israel. Israel's the espouser of those values, not the other guys that you're on seem to be on the team with. Any case, there's this smallness, this edge, this ability to stick in through the dark thing.
And I think that's always the cause, be it sort of wanton evil in the case of Bilam, or the breakdown that you're describing in this foaming Jew, which I'm going to remember that phrase, is the inability to see the full picture. You know, and this is, as someone who is truly a student of history and thinks it's so critical that we as a people and as a species, humanity, we need to understand that there's always processes going on and that organic processes in particular are always messy, right? And that if you walked in at the moment, you know, right before birth, and you didn't know what was going on, you'd say, my gosh, this woman is dying. This room is filled with death. Like, when I get out of here, right? If you just stick around and you see what's about to happen, you'll actually see that this was the most life-giving event ever, right? But an inability to hold through those moments of pain by using a commitment to bringing life into the world, yeah, it brings about death. And that's exactly what he's trying to do.
Okay, but he's not going to be allowed to do that. And instead, he's going to say some of the more colorful and beautiful blessings that the Jewish people ever got, all right? Nahafoch hu. It gets the opposite, and he says some of the famous phrases, Mi mana afar Yaakov, umispar et rova Yisrael. He says, who has counted the dust of Jacob or numbered a quarter of Israel? Okay? And he says, I think I missed the one I wanted to say. Anyway, how can I curse, which God has not cursed? How can I anger? Hashem is not angry. And basically, he's going to say, what I just said, which is, you know, Israel is beautiful. Like, the dust of Israel is beautiful. And also, some people explain that what I translate in English here as quarter in the art scroll is really the beauty of Jewish procreation, right? Jewish sexuality has a purity in it. That's going to come back at the end of the Torah portion where the suggestion of Bilam to Balak is the way to beat the Jewish people is to mess up with their sexuality, detaching them from purity and from a godly way of doing things, and thereby kind of making God angry or distancing himself from them.
I mean, this is, in my mind, the underlying theme of the entire parsha, actually. I mean, you pointed out, I let it go at the time, but that Vayakar, right? That's how God happened upon Bilam, as opposed to Vayikra, that he called to him with a sense of intimacy, right? And Bilam's weird pointing out, like, the fecund nature of the Jews in their and their reproduction. And it comes back a few places that we're not going to drag through here. This idea that the Jews are having children, they're reproducing, that this is what God wants. It's a strange image, but I'll try to be as delicate as possible. That in the act of sexual intimacy, there's a tremendous amount of waste. Tremendous amount of waste, right? One sperm out of how many millions and millions and millions actually makes it. It's very easy to look at a situation like that and say, well, that was just random. It's completely meaningless. You're a product of complete happenstance from the beginning. You think that your life means anything? I can point to its origin and say it could have been otherwise. And there's two ways in which humanity deals with the fact that it could have been otherwise. One is it could have been otherwise, and therefore what is meaningless. Or the other, and that's what Bilam does, he's just trying to point out, like, he wants to, but God reverses his words. He wants to point out, this is all just meaningless happenstance. The other, though, is because it could have been otherwise, what is so precious because it's unique.
Again, we're talking about what we talked about with the donkey, which is, like, is there a God or isn't there?
Yes.
Are things happenstance or maybe there's a sign? Maybe there's somebody's talking to you.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, God. All right. God bless all of you guys out there to make good decisions. Everybody feel good. Everybody have atzlacha. My boy, by the way, Elazar Menachem Ben Malka, who suffered from purpura, an unpleasant little blood reaction to
strep.
That's right. He's doing better. Not 100%, though. Not 100%. He's not. It's at least minimally 2 week thing, but wow. It's more like a month thing. And he's still a little weak and not quite himself yet. So, yeah, but God bless that. God bless him and God bless all of the sick people.
Amen.
I've been praying a lot for people who haven't had children. I have a lot of friends like that for one reason or another, either unmarried or married and not having children. God bless all of you guys. I'm really...
Amen. Yeah. Mamash.
I was at a very special tomb today. I went to the tomb of Gershon Kitover, the brother-in-law and the student of the Baal Shem Tov.
On the Mount of Olives.
And weirdly, I didn't exactly know where it was, and I went today for the first time.
You just found it?
Somebody told me, and I'm like, that, because he said that one blue stone in this area. I'm like, yeah, I've seen it before. I'd never examined it, and there I went there today. I got there, I was like crying, and I opened up a book of Psalms. The exact Psalm that I found at the Baal Shem Tov's tomb was, and I opened it there, was the one I opened up here. Really, it was awesome. Anyway, so now we're going to go through this triad. The first triad we said was going to be the famous phrase, you know, the dust of Jacob. This time, he says, Balak, remember the guy who's hiring, he says, okay. That didn't work out right. He says, listen, let me take you to a different place. There you will only see just the edge, Ephes Katzeo, just the tiniest of edge. Tir'e, v'kulo lo tir'e, but the whole of it you shall not see. V'kabeno li misham, curse them from there.
Ooh.
You won't see all of Jewish history. You won't see all the nation. You won't see all of Israel. You'll just see the criminal, the dark, the. So imagine you bump into a person, right? This is like a Shlomo Karbach story. You bump into a person and he just acts bad, and you just say, "That's who that guy is." That's
yep.
My mom tells a story that one time the secretary, when she was in the 70s, was being unpleasant to her, and my mom like chewed her back out a little bit, and they were like, "Don't you know?" Somebody said to her, "Like, don't you know who this person is?" Her son was just killed in a terrorist attack. And my mom was like, my mom said to me, from that day on, I learned I never judge people by the moment I see them. You know, see the broad, you don't know the broader thing.
Nope.
Just see, okay. And the second cursing opportunity comes back, Bilam, and he says, guess what? God did not see darkness in Jacob, badness in Jacob. And he didn't see Israel bad. He saw it good. I'm just finding the key line here. The one that says, where's the Am Levadad Yishkon line?
It's in the beginning.
The first one? I lost the Am Levadad Yishkon one, which is a nation that will dwell alone. I thought it was in the second one. But in any case.
It's here.
Which verse you got?
It's the 23rd chapter, 9th verse.
Ninth verse. Okay, so right. There, I was looking for. From its origins, it is like rock. It is rock-like. From the hills, I see it. Behold, it is a nation that will dwell in solitude and not be reckoned amongst the nations. Okay, in the second blessings that were turned around from a curse, he says, one of my favorite lines. He says, "Hen am kelavi akum ukeari itnasa lo yishkav ad yochal teref." The dam chadadim yishte. Behold, the people will arise like a lion cub and raise itself like a lion. It will not lie down until it consumes prey and drinks the blood of the slain.
So why does that appeal to you?
I like that. I like that very much. I like the drinking the blood of the slain. I like that. But that's the part that all the stickers that they make out of this verse always
leave
skip.
Off.
Yeah. I'm like, no, that's the best part. That's the best part. You got
the blood drinking thing is not so good in our history. I think I can understand why Jews are not making bumper stickers about drinking blood.
You know what it is? You got to go strong. And my favorite thing that ever happened is when they're like, Esther, you know, they killed the 10 sons of Haman. She's like, hang him anyway. Everybody's got to see that the 10 sons of Haman, they got to go down all the way. It's the same thing. Like, I'm fighting with UNESCO now. Whatever we're like going to win. I'm like, take it all the way, people. Go for the jugular. Finish them off totally. Okay, of course, you know, the chances are they're probably going to vote against us. Of course, I'm not going to give that any energy. I'm going to believe only in the good. But still, like with enemies, you've got to defeat them all the way. You got to finish them off. And whatever, speaking like a right winger. Anyway.
Bloodthirsty. You're going to get the bloodthirsty label.
No, it's not blood.
Just talking about drinking blood.
Okay. The lion drinks the blood. A Jew should not want... The greatest mistake that was ever made was when Saul didn't kill
Agag.
You got to finish it off. Don't like let it have a place in this world.
Well, there's that place of surety that comes with the connection to God, which is what lacked there. Right? And it's a frightening thing. It's for sure a frightening thing. And in many ways, by the way, in his final vision here, Bilaam sees Amalek. And he calls him Reshit Goyim. Calls Amalek the beginning of the nations.
Head of nations.
And it's because there are really two possible starting points for human consciousness, which is absolute relativism. Listen, Amalek says, don't tell me about this good, evil thing. Okay, sometimes this guy's bad, sometimes that guy's bad. You know, you're not going to get anywhere convincing me you should finish off your enemies, because who's to say you're not the bad guy in this situation? And that is a way in which humanity works. The other vision is Am Yisrael, which is saying, listen, of course, mercy is a critical value amongst us, and choosing life is what the Torah tells us to do. But in the same way that a surgeon chooses life by cutting off a diseased limb, so too part of choosing life is the assertion that this is evil, and the response to evil is to destroy it. And the inability to do that is really what hobbles us today. And I understand our history. You were in Auschwitz, right? That was pure evil on one hand. But the lesson people draw from it is you should never be sure of anything, because this is where surety leads to. And I'm not so sure that's correct, because the reality is the Nazis did get defeated.
I wrote an essay about this one time, about how the left and the right proverbially see the Holocaust differently. One sees it as, I'm just paraphrasing what you said, just more categorically, which is one sees it, the liberal world sees it as, whoa, every single one of us could become a Nazi. The Jewish people in power, anybody else in power could become a Nazi. There's an evil Nazi within all of us potentially. We have to watch out for that, and we should never do what the Nazis did to us, to anybody else. That's the liberal kind of version of it. And the right-wing version is, no, we the Jewish people are good. And we want to be good. That's our natural state. These people want to destroy us. We should never again allow them to do it. Therefore, we should be strong and armed and never allow them to rear their ugly head again. It's really a great distinction. In any case, final curse is that Bilaam says the famous line, Matovu ohalecha Yaakov mishkanotecha Israel. Oh, how goodly are your tents, Jacob. Meaning to say, he sees the tents, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your dwelling place is Israel. Like, when you're together, Israel, there's a beauty. When the Jewish people are united, I do see the wholeness. I do see the beauty. And he blesses the Jews. Balak, the hirer, the boss, is very upset, claps his hands. By the way, what a great, like, imagery. Like, he claps his hands like, no! Yeah, and it, like, the clapping of the hands, it clinks off that, like, turns off that prophecy moment. It says, I called you, to curse, you ended up blessing three times. Now you better run, because I was gonna honor you, but now I'm not going to. Bilaam says, well, what can I do? I can only do what God said to me. And then he gives him one last prophecy, and basically it's a prophecy about all the nations. And this is exactly what you said. He saw Amalek and declaimed his parable and said, Amalek is the first amongst the nations, but in his end will be eternal destruction. Bilaam goes home at the end. Balak goes on his way. They separate ways. Yet at the end, we're going to learn a few Torah portions later that Bilaam does get the sword run through him at the end.
Well, he stuck around to make sure that actually the plan carries through. And if you want to understand why the rabbis are
Which plan? Of
trying to destroy Am Yisrael.
Right.
Right. If you want to understand why the rabbis were so eager to read between the lines and find how he could be so wicked, which I have had some students who are very uncomfortable with this sort of rabbinic reading. It seems like a character assassination. And yet we see that after the experience of the vision of redemption, of all the blessings that flowed through him toward Am Yisrael from God, you would think that when he left Balak, where would he go? Running toward the camp of Israel, right? It would have been, you know, stripping off his old life, saying, I get it.
Just like you would think that the Germans would be totally not going to vote against us at the UN or be involved in any kind of anti-Israel. You would think that Germany as a whole would be like, either, hey, we're neutral when it comes to Israel. That we got a history there. We're never going to publicly attack them. We might be able to discuss, but we're never going to do that. And yet you find that Germany ends up on the wrong side of the political issues many times.
Oh, sorry to hear that. But what happens is, indeed, instead of running toward the camp of Israel, he sticks around and tries to figure out a way nonetheless to get his reward, right? And I guess we'll speak about when we get to Parshat Pinchas exactly what it was that he devised. But once you see that, once you see that he'd had the experience of a divine revelation of the blessedness of Am Yisrael and nevertheless pursued his own interests, that's what causes the sages to go back and read the story in light of
And the fact that the Jews are going to seek him out and kill him.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is they seek him out and kill him. And then, by the way, very quickly, this whole incident becomes a trope. It becomes a lens through which we understand the relationship between God, Israel, and the nations right down through the prophets. It gets mentioned in Micha. It gets mentioned in a couple other places that don't forget what Bilaam tried to do.
But what is it that he really tried to do?
He, through his vision of blessing, saw that the core purity of Am Yisrael rests in the intimacy of its relations between men and women, between families, between Israel and God. And he understood that if he could corrupt that ever so much, that would completely unravel all of it, because that's what a brit is. It's a covenant. That's why the sign of the brit is on the sexual organ, because it's the place of intimacy where there's a joining. And he knew that if he could place even the slightest corruption there, that it would unravel everything. And that's indeed the advice that he gave, which I think we should speak more about when we get to Pinchas, because it deserves a more in-depth analysis.
So the Netivot Shalom adds to what you're saying, or mirrors it, and just says he was really trying to detach, not kill the Jews, but detach Israel from God.
Yes.
And that was an Et Tzora l'Israel. This was mm-hmm. it was a horrible moment, a great moment. And just the Torah portion ends very dramatically, where you think that he kind of lost the game. He wasn't able to curse the Jews. And yet, something happens at the very end of the Torah portion where the Jewish people start to cohabitate, mingle.
Turn towards harlotry.
That was scary. With the Moabite women, Moabite gals.
Midianite.
No, Moab.
Right.
The Moabite gals. And he, but I think they were involved also, as I remember from the Midrashim. And in any case, guess what? They've got this thing called Baal Peor, right? Which is just so much fun. You get to defecate in front of an idol, and you know I totally get it. People are like, oh, why would you ever? You know what? It's what do you call it? Like, no holds barred.
Yes, it's no holds barred.
Right. It's like
completely release.
Right.
Everything's natural and okay.
Right.
I mean, this is one of the great challenges of Brit, of covenant, is that it is a tremendous demand for discipline and focus in the most intimate, powerful, and what ought to be natural aspects of life. And God says, yes, I didn't create you as an animal. I created you with all these drives in order that you can become a human being, harness them and channel them toward creativity and productivity, and not toward ecstatic release. And that was what was so tempting there.
There's also something about feces, which is, it's like the end of the process.
Well, not only that, but if you think about it, that is where, for children, this is the first place where you impress upon a child that your natural being is not okay.
Right.
Right? Like, meaning, is their natural being, they're just pooping and being wherever they go.
Wait a minute. You just reminded me of something. Freud said that people want to naturally poop their pants. That was a Freudian thing.
Yeah.
They've been conditioned
not to.
Right, but I just... Baal Peor is exactly what he was saying.
Absolutely. This is what I'm driving at. This is what's happening there, is that what's being offered to them is, we'll let you go, we'll let all that conditioning go. All that stuff they told you in school that your parents said, that God said, that Moshe said, that you're not allowed to do, right. Says who? It's natural, man. Do what comes naturally.
By the way, last week's show, you came up with, I said it was like a Torah portion of weird stuff. You said it was the platypus of Torah portions. That's what I called the show, the platypus of Torah portions. Should I call it this week defecating towards idols?
Oh, I would say do what comes naturally. It might be a cleaner version.
Indeed. And then at the very end of the Torah portion, the Jewish people are going so morally depraved that one guy, he's going to take a Midianite princess.
Take matters into his own hands.
Right. And he's going to fornicate with her publicly.
Yes.
And it's like, and it's so, so bad that what we see that is Moses and Aaron are just crying. You're like, no, not you, Moses. You like last Torah portion, you like jumped up and like slayed a giant, man. You're like a Superman. And to see like Moses and Aaron crying, it's like, no, I don't want to see that.
It's hard. Listen, the whole thing is heartbreaking because if you think about it, they have devoted their entire lives to taking these people and taking them out of slavery physically, taking them out of slavery morally and spiritually, you know, binding them to the covenant at Sinai and then repeatedly through all the trials of the book of Bamidbar. And here it's like total breakdown. And you can imagine Moshe is just saying, like, that's it. That's it. I don't have any more.
Right, right. Because this is the ultimate. This is not complaining about food, which is maybe understandable, or wanting to serve God in an ecstatic way of the golden calf, or being afraid of going to the land of Israel. This is plain old ribaldry. Is that the word? Public.
It's just throwing off the yoke. 100%.
Throwing off the yoke. That's it. It's just bacchanalia. You're out. You know.
Yep.
And then a man rises up.
Tididum bum 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 bum.
Right. And his name is Pinchas, Phineas. And this Pinchas, he's going to do an act. And he's going to take a lance. That's what I think of it as, a lance. And he's going to lance through. He's going to run through, is the proper word, these two public fornicators. And with that return, bring peace back into the camp. He's going to ameliorate God's anger. He's going to personify God's anger and in a sense rip it away. Instead of Moses doing one of these things where it's like, God, listen, really, if you go to kill the people, it's going to look bad for you. I'm your PR agent. I'm doing my best to make you look good out here, so come on, help me out. Instead, he's going to say, no. There is a righteous anger here. I'm going to actually act on your righteous anger. And instead of you plaguing, instead of doing the Jewish, shtadlanut, trying to ask God not to kill the Jews, I'm going to do it for you. I'm going to run these two people through for you. And he gets this Pinchas becomes a high priest.
Well, wait. Yeah? You know, the reality is that one of the most powerful tools of storytelling is where you end the story.
Okay.
And I think it's quite important that our parsha ends with Pinchas running them through.
Right.
And we don't actually know what God thinks of it yet.
Right. That's right. You're absolutely right.
We don't know yet.
You're absolutely right.
And I think the power, remember, was the sages who broke up the Torah portions into this order. Because I think that there's a deep question embedded there.
Right.
And they wanted you to think about it.
Think about it. I think I remember talking about this last year. That's right.
He did it. You're absolutely right. He channeled the divine anger and he stopped the plague.
You know what? Is that good or bad? I don't know.
Stay tuned.
Next week. That's right. I don't know. We'll learn more about that in Parshat Pinchas. Rabbi Mike Foyer, it's been a wonderful hour to be with you. I have to tell you, it's been a respite in my busy and emotionally charged life right now. So it's been wonderful to see you. So I want to thank you personally for this time.
Always a pleasure.
Wonderful. I want to thank all of you out there for listening. If you listened all the way to the end, God bless you. You get
a special prize.
You have 4 gold stars. And just a little bit more time in a good mindset, in a good place. Good luck with the rest of everything today. All of you out there, write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, ravmike@thelandofisrael.com. Check out jbrick.com for your kids and maybe for yourself, a little Jewish Lego set on your workplace. A little, maybe a mitzvah tank or whatever he's got ready for you. That's going to be great. And folks, stay part of the story. Remember that what we learned today is very, very real outside. This Torah portion is totally reflective of a reality that we're facing right now around the world. We've talked lots about it. I want to hear from you. Write me an email. Don't be lazy. Write me a little email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Stay tuned. Stay calm. stay connected, stay part of the story, and stay excited about this incredible time that we're living in. Listen to God. Just tune in. He's broadcasting 24/7. And be good out there. Shabbat shalom. God bless you. And shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Stay tuned for part two of the Yishai Fleischer Show on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com, where Yishai joins Rabbi Shmuley Boteach in Poland on the road to Auschwitz.
Josh Haston here, Israel Uncensored, the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Check out my interview with Roger Staubach, Eric Dickerson, NFL Hall of Famers here in Israel.
I've always wanted to come to the Holy Land, never been here, you know, seen it on television. When I think of history, I think of Israel because, you know, we talk about the United States. You know, we've got Philadelphia with and Boston with 200-300 years. That's no history. I mean, it's real history here.
Check that out on my show, Israel Uncensored, the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, and I'm in a car with Shmuley Boteach and his whole family, and we're heading to Auschwitz. Right, that's right. We're in Poland right now. We're just in Krakow, and we're driving about an hour towards Auschwitz. Shmuley, tell me, Rabbi Shmuley, tell me a little bit. Of course, America's rabbi, and all my listeners know who you are. Tell me a little bit about why we're here together in Poland and why we're heading towards this kind of, how should we call it, hallowed site that has become hallowed through the death of Jews. What are we doing here?
Well, it's the most horrible place on earth, and it's the incarnation of evil. Unfortunately, it's an evil that engulfed our people, and we go to remember those who died, and we have to have a newfound commitment to the lives of the people who are with us today, for Israel to be strong and defend itself, because anti-Semitism is continuing to rear its ugly head. But the reason that we're here today is that as you and I speak and record this, UNESCO is in Krakow, a city that had 80,000 Jews before the war, almost none afterward. It was one of the great bastions of European Jewish life. They were decimated, annihilated. The ghetto in Krakow was made famous by Steven Spielberg and Schindler's List. And UNESCO, the United Nations cultural organization, decides to hold a vote today to divorce the city of Hebron from all Jewish recognition, from all Jewish historical attachment. It's an anti-Semitic attack by the UN. But it's particularly insensitive, almost shocking to be honest, that they would choose to do it in Krakow, 40 miles from Auschwitz.
It's shocking. On the other hand, that's been their tactic all along. They've been going after the big fish. They go right for Jerusalem. They don't say Tel Aviv is not Jewish. They say Jerusalem's not Jewish. Jerusalem's Al-Quds. And Hebron, Jewish? No. This is actually the tomb of the fathers and mothers. Is actually the Ibrahimi Mosque. They're always going for the big fish and challenging us on the very core, the very heart of our narrative, of our story. And they don't kind of back down from it. Now they're doing it on the international scene.
Well, it's shocking because while we know about the long history of anti-Israel prejudice and bias on behalf of the United Nations, we still thought the United Nations, even lacking decency at many times, still had some political sophistication. We thought that they knew that their resolutions can't necessarily, their anti-Israel discrimination can't necessarily be practiced in certain locations. And you would think that Poland in general, and Krakow in particular, would be one of those locations that they realize we can't erase Jewish memory, not after 6 million Jews died there, not after they returned into ash with no memory, no headstones. We know their names, but there's no grave marker for them. So we thought that the UN would, even they would kind of have red lines. It turns out they don't.
So the foreign ministry, the deputy foreign minister, Tzipi Chotubeli, gathered all of the foreign ministers, foreign ambassadors that are in Israel that have UNESCO membership, and gave them a briefing explaining the facts, telling them that it is not a city in danger, as the Palestinian delegation would have you believe. She showed them maps. She showed them charts. She told them about our connection. Carmel Shama, who's a former Knesset member, is coming tonight to Krakow, and his message is the same. Israel is not endangering the tomb of the fathers and mothers. In fact, they're allowing a religious freedom there, and actually Israel is the best way to defend religious freedom. He's also asking for a secret ballot vote at UNESCO, that should help, in his mind, get a few more countries to vote our way.
So that's been some of the diplomatic fronts. However, you've also been a little bit disappointed, I think, at some of the behavior of Israel, of some Knesset members, important ones as well, who have not really stepped up and made us stink. You've been one of the real leaders in kind of making an issue out of this. Coming to Krakow today, you had a press conference, a demonstration outside of the Ramah Synagogue, holding a Sefer Torah that you're bringing today to Auschwitz, that your organization, the World Values Network, is bringing to Auschwitz. But you've been also a little bit disappointed that not everybody in Israel is up in arms about this delegitimization of our very roots, the story of Hebron.
Well, I'm disappointed because what's happening does not reflect the facts on the ground. And I feel Israel really should be a bit more vociferous in making its case. What I mean by that is, I'm not like you. I'm not an expert in Hebron, Yishai. You're an official spokesman. You know, I'm someone who visits Hebron regularly. I was just in Israel. I visited Hebron twice in 1 week. I met some of your friends there. So I look at it from the perspective of a non-expert who loves Hebron and who visits and who's Jewish and who's attached to the city. What I see is a tiny little sprinkling of Jewishness surrounded by a massive Arab-Palestinian presence, 150,000 Palestinians, 800 Jews. And even that tiny little sprinkling of Jews and Jewishness is almost too much for the world. It must be made Judenrein. It must be emptied of Jews. And the word Judenrein is one that has a particular resonance in Krakow, particular resonance in Poland. Krakow now is seeing a resurgence of Jewishness. I spoke to the Jewish community at JCC over Shabbat. It was quite an amazing experience. We had Shabbat dinner with 650 people as part of the Krakow Jewish Festival, which attracts 10,000 non-Jews who are interested in Jewish life. See, here you have the Polish people making an effort to remember their vanished Jewish community, murdered by the Nazi Germans. And then the United Nations struts in and tries to erase Jewish memory in the Holy Land from the soil of Poland. Enough bad things have happened in the soil of Poland. So I felt that the state of Israel could take, and still can take, a much more public, a vociferous line against this outrage, because this is outrageous. And I think that most people would see it as outrageous. Yesterday, in front of these 10,000 people, Rabbi Michael Shudroth, the chief rabbi of Poland, who's a very special man, he spoke about this. He said to all the non-Jewish Poles gathered to listen to Jewish music and learn about Jewish culture, he said to them, do you guys realize that tomorrow UNESCO's coming to your town and they're going to try to say that Hebron has no Jewish connection? And we need you to do something about it. So if the chief rabbi can speak out in Krakow, the prime minister of Israel can speak out, the defense minister can speak out, the Knesset can speak out. And there's Israeli officials who are visiting Poland constantly, and they haven't spoken out here, and I think they should.
So when I had the great privilege of joining you today in Krakow, and the way I did it was that I flew 5 a.m., which means I had to be at the airport at somewhat like 2 in Israel, so I really didn't sleep. 5 a.m. I got on a flight, got to Warsaw. From Warsaw, grabbed another flight to Krakow. Went to my hotel room, which my good friend Eric Ross hooked up, and he's my monk friend here and a great listener, great friend of the show, and he hooked me up. I dropped my stuff in the room. My phone rang. It's you, Rabbi Shmuley Botech. He said, get over there.
Straight to the press conference.
Right, so ran to the press conference, and you said something to me which was obsequious at the time. I didn't understand what you were saying. You said to me, I need you to hold the Sefer Torah. I'm like, okay, Rabbi Shmuley must have taken a Torah out of the Aron Kodesh, and he's making a classic kind of, you know, a Jewish, kind of Avi Weiss style a demonstration outside. I didn't know what you meant by Sefer Torah. I get there, I see this very beautiful, kind of small, mini Sefer Torah you're holding in your hands, and only through your talk did I understand why you had that Sefer Torah. Please explain.
Well, we just had our gala dinner, which the World Values Network hosts every year, and every year we celebrate champions of Jewish values, people who have excelled in one of three areas: promoting families, promoting the State of Israel, and fighting genocide. So, for example, President Paul Kagame of Rwanda was an honoree for friendship with the Jewish people and stopping the 1994 Rwandan genocide. He was an honoree this year. But the major personality whose memory we honored this year was Elie Wiesel. And we wrote a Sefer Torah for the victims of the Holocaust, the victims of the Rwandan genocide, the Tutsi who were murdered in the Rwandan genocide, and the memory of Elie Wiesel. And I have that Torah with me because I wanted to bring it to Auschwitz. I took it to Israel as well. And a Torah written for this, the martyred 6 million will be brought to the place where 1/6 of them were murdered at Auschwitz, the most famous killing zone. And that Torah is what we held today when we spoke about Judaism's second holiest city, Hebron, the Jewish people's first capital, Hebron, the city bought by bought by Abraham for his for his family to be buried, where the patriarchs and matriarchs are married, buried, Hebron. And so to have the Torah there made it extra special and extra holy.
So we're carrying this Torah right now in the car, and I want to ask you kind of one final question. By the way, when you first offered me, I didn't know we were going to Auschwitz today. So I called my wife. I said, Rabbi Shmuley wants me to go to Auschwitz. Silence on the other side of the line. And she starts to cry, my wife. And she says, Yishai, you know, so much of my family, my Hungarian family, was murdered specifically in Auschwitz. And I myself have my great uncle survived Auschwitz, and my wife's grandparents survived Auschwitz. So, you know, when I heard my wife cry, I really was like, kind of like, oh my God, I'm going to Auschwitz. And I kind of, when you said it to me, I was just like, I don't want to go to Auschwitz, kind of, you know. But then I saw the emotion in your face, I heard my wife's voice, and I was like, okay. You know, it kind of hit home. And I wanted to finish off with the last question, which is kind of a more personal question, which is, every time I see you, speaking of family, speaking of destroyed family, every time I see you, if it's at APAC or in other places, and here in Krakow, you're hauling your whole family along. That's one of the things that people don't know about the Rabbi Shmuley Boteach kind of secret, is that your family is part of your whole entourage. You kind of seem to kind of get them involved in everything, and the children, and then your wife, Debbie, and everybody's around you. Why is that? Why do you haul your family across the world on these trips and in these adventures?
Well, let me respond to your points in the order that they were made. In terms of visiting Auschwitz, every Jew has to visit Auschwitz. We're not here to remember, to celebrate, God forbid, gore, gas chambers, crematoria. We are here to remember 6 million Jews who don't even have a stone marker. We're here for the 6 million who are in heaven to know they will never be forgotten. We are here to honor and stand by their memory. Auschwitz touches me to my soul. It touches me to my core. It is the most horrible place, and it consumes 6 million of our Jewish brothers and sisters. I was in Auschwitz just 7 weeks ago. And I was there with, at the same time as the Israeli chief of staff, Gadi Eisenkot. And we were there with a lot of senior Israeli officers, some of whom are close friends of mine, leading officers who were the head of the Israeli commando units. And to know that the Jewish people today have an army to ensure that never again actually means never again, because otherwise, without an army, without a righteous army defending human life, human liberties, and democracy in the state of Israel, then never again is only a slogan. Because it will happen unless righteous people defend themselves against the evil and against the wicked. We have to hate evil. We have to fight evil. Let us not forget that as you and I drive to Auschwitz right now, Yishai, the forces arrayed against the Jews in the Middle East, Hezbollah, Iran, Hamas, they are positively genocidal. Unlike the Nazis who tried to hide their genocidal intent, there are some examples where Hitler spoke openly about annihilating the Jewish people, most notably his famous speech at the Kroll Opera House, where he predicted the annihilation of the Jewish people, January 1939, before the outbreak of the Second World War, or alluding to it kind of in Mein Kampf, where he said, if some of the poison gas of the Great War had been used on a few thousand Jews, we wouldn't have been in the situation we're in. But mostly the Germans tried to mask their genocidal ambitions. And then you'll see in Auschwitz, they blew up the crematoria before they left. They wanted to hide what they did. That is not the case with Hamas. That is not the case with Hezbollah or Iran. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei speaks all the time about annihilating Israel. He is proud of it. And they deny the Holocaust openly. Hamas, it's in their charter. We are going to kill all the Jews. Not just in Israel, by the way. The Jews of Poland, the Jews of the UK, the Jews of Kentucky, and the Jews of Singapore. They're all going to die if Hamas has its way. And Hezbollah is the same. So we have to go to Auschwitz to also commit ourselves to defending life in the present. About family, look, I mean, isn't that what it's all about? All of these families were killed together. They arrived in these boxcars. And if Jewish parents had to watch their children in such horrible circumstances, I as a father can can watch my children, thank God, in living circumstances. I can take them to Israel, and we can go together to Jerusalem, to Hebron, to Marat HaMachpelah. We can march, as I brought my kids to the March of the Living here 7 weeks ago. We can visit Auschwitz together now and remember the Jews together. But I am a father first and foremost. I am a father and husband before anything else. And the Jewish community survives specifically because of the family. You and I both love Israel. We cherish Israel. You live in Israel. That's the Jewish homeland. It's the promised land. But to a great extent, because we Jews have been a diaspora people for so long, our homeland was also the nuclear family. It was the inseparable, indivisible family that can never be fragmented. And that's why I said it probably struck some people as incongruent. I said that our organization, the World Values Network, has three objectives: defend Israel, stop genocide, and what's the third? Keep families together. Because that's an integral part of Jewish values. Mishinantan lovenecha, teach your children. Our kids are young, and we're still taking them to Auschwitz. Now, we'll be careful about what we expose them to, but they need to know. They do know, and they need to know.
All right. Just one last thing is that I would be remiss if I didn't mention that your title is kind of America's rabbi. But really, at the end of the day, there's a great element of Chabad and the Rebbe of Lubavitch, who really was one of the people who reached out to Jews, brought them back to Judaism. You're doing it on a mass media scale as well. And I think that there's a... there's a strength that emanates from the Lubavitch Rebbe, and I feel very privileged to be going with you today to Auschwitz with that strength of we're going to Auschwitz, we're going to get kind of strengthened through it in order to fight that war and to bring Jewish people to a greater awareness of Judaism and a greater awareness of their own strength.
The Rebbe was quite simply the proudest Jew I ever met. He hated Jewish subservience. You know, it's worth mentioning, since you bring up the Rebbe, firstly, it was his Yahrzeit last week, the third day of Tammuz, 23rd Yahrzeit. But we just left Krakow, where Pope John Paul II was Cardinal Archbishop for many years prior to becoming Pope in the late 70s. And he was a great friend of the Jewish people. But the Rebbe was opposed to Jews having meetings with the Pope, kind of, and it led to some controversy recently when a Chabad rabbi went to see Pope Francis. And I watched the Rebbe's tapes about meeting popes, and I've met Pope Benedict, and I've met Pope Francis, and I only do what the Rebbe wants. But what the Rebbe said, what he didn't want was Jews feeling secondary. He didn't want us to visit popes as supplicants, because he didn't feel the Jews were ever secondary. We had to meet members of other faiths as equals, and that's why the Rebbe fought so hard for the territorial integrity of the State of Israel. He didn't want Israel ever making territorial concessions, because that would be a concession that Israel is an occupier, which it isn't. This is the land that we are attached to for thousands of years. He was opposed to even an inch of land being forfeited. And he predicted in 1978, when he started speaking about the Camp David Accords, that if Israel gave back Sinai, which they eventually did, under a very right-wing prime minister, Menachem Begin, he predicted that three things would happen. Number one, he said that Israel's legitimacy would be eroded and its claims to the land would be denied, and it would be labeled an occupier. He almost predicted the rise of the BDS movement, Israel being boycotted for occupying other people's land. Number two, he said it would increase terror, which unfortunately has really happened. So many thousands of Jews have died since those accords. And number three, he said that it would create an insatiable appetite on the part of the world for Jewish land. So all three, and he said this in 1978, 1979, and unfortunately all three have come to pass. I miss the Rebbe very much, and I think we have to recommit ourselves to his vision for Israel. The Rebbe believed that all human beings, of course, are equally the children of God. He was a universalist. He always spoke about the Jewish people's obligations to the non-Jewish world. But giving up our land, this tiny, tiny, tiny little piece of land, is not one of those obligations. But finally, your point about my own Chabad identity. Chabad is a global movement. They're doing a great work, great job in Krakow. And it's time for Chabad to recommit themselves to the Rebbe's vision for Israel, to be involved in Yudan Shomron, to be involved in standing up against the demonization of the brave settler population, and seeing in those Jews who are taking these rock-strewn areas of Yudan Shomron and growing things and cultivating it and civilizing the land and creating jobs for Jew and Arab alike. It's time for Chabad to be more invested in the battle for their good name.
Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, we're on the road to Auschwitz. Your whole family's here as well. And I'm a little bit nervous inside. I'm a little bit excited, but I'm definitely inspired to see the pain and to say that new Jewish phrase, never again, and at the same time say Kaddish for all those who have been lost, but to pray for those who have not been lost and to rededicate ourselves to protecting the future and to protecting Jewish rights, but also human rights throughout the world, which is what you're doing on the World Values Network. Rabbi Shmuley, thanks so much for being with us.
Let me add one thing.
Go ahead.
You do realize what Auschwitz is. Auschwitz is, God forbid, what happens if the Jews don't have a state when they come under threat and they have nowhere to go and no one to fight for them. Auschwitz could not have existed had there been a state of Israel. So let's not forget that as well. Auschwitz is the... It's not the reason we have Israel. We have Israel because we are a people, we are a nation, and we had Israel thousands of years ago. And we've been there continually since. It was promised us by God, and it's the Jewish homeland. But Auschwitz could not be if there was an Israel. These people had nowhere to go, and they had no one to fight for them. Never again is Israel writ large.
Yet sometimes it breaks my heart when we allow never again to happen. And it does happen when terror strikes against us and when we're not vociferous enough, to use your words, to strike back at Hamas, at Hezbollah, at Iran, who are the would-be Nazis of today. We have to recommit ourselves to being not just, you know, not just saying the phrase never again, but to really, as you said very correctly, which I really never hear anybody say, which is hate evil. Hate evil and be willing to root it out. We say every Friday night, Ohavei Hashem, Si Nura. Lovers of God must hate evil and must push back. Well, those are right words as we head into Auschwitz. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Yishai.
Who are we as a people? Who are we as a nation? What does it mean to be a Jew in the land of Israel, as a Jew in Judea? What is our message to the world? We're finally back in our land, and we get to ask these questions.
Be'ezrat Hashem, we're going to make Judea and Samaria an issue for the entire world to know that the Jews have a place in the world.
Israel Inspired with Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.